Order the Senate Committee on the Environment and Natural Resources. Today is February 2nd, 2015. Welcome. This is our first meeting of this committee, this legislative session. Won't be our last. We have a few things to do today. We'll be adopting some committee rules. I see there's a lot of interest in that here, so we'll get right to that. But before we do that, we'll do some just brief introductions. Most of you probably know who many of us are, but maybe not. So I will start. My name is Chris Edwards. I am the state senator from Eugene. I also represent Junction City. My background professionally before entering the legislature was in the forest products industry, and I've been serving in the legislature for 8 years now. This is my first time chairing this committee. Last 5 years I've been on Ways and Means, and as I'm learning, there's a little bit more action sometimes in the policy committee. So anyway, today will be my first day with this gavel, and it'll be an interesting session, and I think a good session for us. So that's it. I'll wrap it up there. Perhaps we'll start down with you, Senator Thompson, and we'll just go down the dais.
Senator Chuck Thompson from Hood River, Happy Valley, around the mountain, southeast Portland, Damascus, Clackamas area. This is my second stint on this committee. I don't ever remember this many people showing up for one of these meetings. So, Senator Edwards, I think you now definitely overrule our old Senator Dingfelder by the amount of people you brought into the first meeting. And there's an overflow room, too. So I'm looking for great things. I didn't actually ask to be back on this committee, but I'm here.
We're glad to have you, Senator.
Great. I'm Michael Dembro, and I represent Senate District 23. That's northeast, southeast Portland, as well as the city within a city of Maywood Park. And I am the late chair of this committee. Well, late, that's probably I'm the former chair. Up to 2 weeks ago, I was the chair of this committee. It was a very interesting assignment for me. I kind of parachuted into it and learned a lot in the last year. It's hard to believe that it was just a year. There was so much to learn. I insisted on remaining on this committee, even though I was asked to chair the new workforce committee, which will also be a very interesting assignment. But I developed a real passion and some level of expertise, some small level of expertise on these issues. And I really look forward to working with my committee colleagues, despite the fact that Senator Thompson is back on the committee.
Senator Olson.
I'm Senator Alan Olson. I represent Senate District 20, which runs from Charbonneau to Estacada and from Highway 212, 224 south to Molino. It's a large district, very rural, and important that I'm on veterans or on energy. I can't even remember what committee it's I'm on now. Environment and Natural Resources. This is my fifth year as being the vice chair. I have really taken a tremendous liking to this, and I'm trying to specifically work in the energy field. Had some extracurricular study in energy and to find out exactly what makes everything tick and how we can advance our state through energy and its use.
Hi, I'm Floyd Przonski, State Senator District 4, and all due respect to the chair, I am the senator from Eugene. It just happens that I also represent all of East Lane County and all of East Douglas County. It's the largest landmass of a Senate district west of the Cascades. I am thrilled to be back on the committee. I had the opportunity to serve on Environment and Natural Resources in its previous configuration in 5, 7, and 9, if I'm not mistaken.
Don't forget 11.
Yeah. That's here 11 too. Okay, I'm getting old too.
You sit right over there.
Yeah. Well, I thought your first session was in 9.
No, 11.
Oh, okay. It was a great opportunity then, and I had the opportunity to serve with Arnie Roblin on the Natural Resources Committee when we split off, and doing the economic development and rural communities. I look forward to the work that we have today, as well as getting our rules done. It looks like we're going to have a lot of input, and look forward to all the other topics we'll have, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Przonski. And before we move on with the rules, I want to introduce the staff as well. And you know, when I got this assignment, everybody asked me, who's your committee administrator? And they said, is it one of the best? And I said, yeah, it's one of the best, but I can't remember which one. And they said, well, you're fine either way. The best are great. And so Beth Riley is our committee administrator. Beth, you want to tell us just a little bit about yourself and introduce our committee assistant? Yeah.
So my name is Beth Riley, and I've been with the legislature since 2008. The Senate Environment and Natural Resources was actually the first committee that I had the opportunity to work with back in 2009. So I'm looking forward to the upcoming session. And we have an amazing committee assistant that is brand new this session to us, but we got incredibly lucky, and that's Sam Koopman. So we're very thankful for her help this upcoming session. She's just hitting the ground running. So
great. Thank you, and welcome. So, first item of business, we have to adopt some committee rules. So, Beth, you want to give us a quick overview of the committee rules?
Chair Edwards and committee members, so the committee rules you have in front of you are fairly standard. The new addition that you didn't see in the 2013 rules was the rule about posting an amendment on OLIS at least 1 hour before the committee is to take action on that amendment. So that would be at a work session. And that is fairly standard.
Is there any problems or concerns with the rules? Okay. I guess we got to open up. Okay. Open up an organizational meeting for the purpose of adoption of the committee rules. Any questions, concerns about the rules? Okay. Are there any objections to adopting the rules as presented?
I get to make a motion.
Do we have to have a motion? Okay.
Senator Edwards. Or, no, I guess it's me. Chair Edwards, I move to adopt the proposed committee rules dated 2015.
Senator Olson has moved, has gotten ahead of the chair, and moved to adopt the proposed committee rules dated 2015. Is there any discussion? Okay. Seeing none, so ordered.
I think as long as there's no opposition.
So.
Okay.
We ready to move on? All right. Let's get to the next order of business. We are going to have a public hearing. We're going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 324. And just so everybody knows, I'll lay out the structure of how the meetings, this public hearing is going to go. We're going to have kickoff testimony from Senator Beyer. Senator Ferrioli will then be testifying. Then we'll have DEQ. We'll have a couple of folks to explain the structure of the bill and the underlying program. Then we'll have a panel of opponents to the bill that will have 15 minutes. Then we'll have a panel of proponents that will have 15 minutes. Then we'll move into a timed public testimony, 2 minutes apiece. We have a lot of folks here. This room is full. We have overflow seating in hearing room B. And we will be calling out who's up, and then we'll be calling out who's on deck so that you can be ready. If we do not get through everybody today, and I do not believe that we will get through everybody today, we will carry over the public hearing today until Wednesday for the purposes of hearing testimony that was signed up today, for hearing testimony from people that signed up to testify today. So with that, Senator Beyer, you want to kick us off?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
He may tell us he's the actual senator from Eugene as well.
He may. But only two of us live in Eugene. And only one of us represents two-thirds of the city.
Good afternoon, Senators. Lee Beyer. I represent Senate District 6, which is Central Linn and Lane Counties, and Senators, I'm also a representative of the city of Eugene. Small piece. You two have a much bigger piece than I do. Senators, I'm here today in support of the Clean Fuels Bill. And I would start out a little bit just telling you why I'm concerned about this. And let me just start out by telling you, this past weekend I was at an event and meeting with a number of people who I'd met and before from the Marshall Islands. A lot of them are here, U.S. Protectorate used to be, and telling me about their islands and what's going on there. The largest island in the Marshall Islands, the highest peak is 6 feet above sea level. There are literally tens of thousands of people that live on these islands. Senators, if as a global society we do not address climate change, within a few decades there will be no Marshall Islands. That's a concern. And it's not just the Marshall Islands. That one just hit home to me as I was talking with these people and the pride of their community. So that is an issue. Now, one of the things that I think you'll hear a lot about is that Oregon by itself can really not address the problem. This is a global issue, a national issue, and that is indeed true. But you got to start somewhere. You got to start somewhere. I started addressing these issues or learning about these issues during my almost decade service as the chair of the Oregon Public Utility Commission. Did a lot primarily on the natural gas and the electrical side working on those, but I had the opportunity that some may not have to meet with a lot of people nationally and internationally to discuss this issue, and I became convinced that while I'm not a scientist and I don't know this, the vast majority of scientists in the world believe climate change is a problem. It is a problem. It's probably not, you know, just looking at our age group, it's probably not something that's as directly going to impact us, but it's sure going to address or affect our grandchildren if we don't do something. So that to me brings it down to an emotional level. So why this? Over the years, we've done a lot on the electrical side, I should say, over the last decade, and I think we've done a good job. And if you look at Oregon's contribution to climate change pollution, there are two major sources. The first major source is vehicle fuels. The second major source is fossil fuel generation of electricity. We've done an awful lot on the fossil fuel side, and we'll do more. And one of the things we've learned out of that experience, and I think it's very clear, is renewable energy production has significantly dropped in cost as people have invested more in it through various governmental regulations and various interests in that area. The fact of the matter is, if you looked at something as simple as solar cells, as little as 5 years ago, they were 5 to 6 times more expensive than they are today. And I think one of the lessons to be learned from that, as well as with wind and some of the others, is when you create a clear public policy, entrepreneurs invest. If they know there's going to be a return, they will invest in trying to find solutions to the problem. So when we look at the fuels issues today, I'm not suggesting to you that we can solve all of the problems today if we were to try and switch immediately to something else. What I am suggesting to you is that if we want people to invest and try to find solutions, you have to send a clear public message that the governments and the public is going to be there for them if they make the investment. There's a reasonable chance of return. So that's important. So what this bill is about is fairly simple. In 2009, the legislature, and I wasn't here then, the legislature passed the clean fuel standards with the intent of encouraging people to switch fuel sources by 2020 by about 10%. What this bill does is it removes that sunset, and some of the amendments will stretch that out to 2025. That effort is not Oregon alone. That effort includes the entire West Coast from British Columbia to Southern California. So if you look at that together, that landmass, while Oregon, with a small percentage of the national population, cannot by itself trigger a big change, the entire West Coast acting together can induce people to invest and look for something different. So that's the thing. And the leaders right now, quite frankly, are British Columbia and California. Both have done a lot. British Columbia is a real trendsetter in some of this stuff, but they've made the investment. They recognize it. So all this does is take the sunset off, and through some of the amendments that you'll hear Mr. Peterson, I believe, talking about, it provides a relief valve. If something goes wrong, if prices escalate faster than anybody thought, if it's injurious to the economy, there's a relief valve built in. The law says that the Environmental Quality Commission has a lot of leeway in keeping costs down, and they have direction to keep costs down. Beyond that, there's a triggering mechanism that says if it goes too far, they suspend it. And I would suggest the real relief valve is the legislature. You know, and I know, that this legislature and any Oregon legislature would not let devastating impacts happen to our citizens. We would step in. And we have a situation now where some may not like this, but at any given time, the legislature is never more than 8 months out of session. So just on a routine basis, when you get the annual reports, if something's not working the way it was envisioned, the legislature has the ability to change that. And in fact, if more emergency action is necessary, we're never more than 72 hours out with the call of an emergency session. So there is the ability, there is the innate ability of the legislature to control what happens here while still sending a positive message to investors. I think that's important. So why, you know, we know why we would want to do this. And I think you're going to hear that. I think most of the testimony against this will focus on biofuels and the different things there. And certainly we have not made the progress in biofuels that any of us would like, although there's been quite a bit of progress recently. I took note that in Kansas just this last year they started up a cellulosic plant that's been relatively less expensive than was anticipated and is not using the food stock. It's not using the corn. It's actually using the corn stalks and the corn cobs. There's a plant over in eastern Oregon that's trying to do cellulosic with wood fiber. I think there's a lot there. Oregon State University is doing incredible research in this area, so we have some promise that something else will happen. So that's there. But I want you to think about something that former Senator Starr and I were encouraging. As some would call it a transition, I'm not sure it's a transition, but fairly simply we could move large fleets. Now, I'm not talking about interstate because that's more of a thing, but in-state or within the region onto alternative fuels such as propane or compressed natural gas. There's also lots of discussion Daimler's doing on natural or liquid natural gas as well for large vehicles. The advantage of using that kind of thing, once you get through the conversion, and there's some issues with that, is that cost, I mean, right off the top, well, today it's a little different because of the price of oil is down, but if you look back 6 months, you were looking at less than 60% of the cost for that. I was talking with a director of the Alternative Fuels Program at Lynn Benton Community College, who was telling me about a discussion he had with a log truck driver, small operation, 10 trucks, spending $30,000 a month on diesel. And he was talking to him about converting to natural gas. And the guy was saying, is this just another one of those nutty liberal ideas? And John said, well, you judge. If I could reduce your $30,000 fuel cost a month by $10,000, is that a nutty liberal idea? Now think about that. cost of conversion is expensive. We have some programs that we put in, tax credits and others, to encourage that. We have some real issues around that. I mean, we got a chicken and egg kind of thing going on in terms of, if you were going to do it, you still need to have fuel stations out there. We don't have those yet, although we have one in Eugene, an investment by a trucking firm that created the first commercial compressed natural gas fueling station in the state. We need to have, make sure that we have mechanics to deal with that, and we need to continue to have improvements in the system. But none of that's going to happen if we don't send a clear message to people that this is the right direction to go. There are alternatives out there. We will make progress. We always do as a society, but you have to give some solidity to the idea. People who are going to invest need to know that we're going to be around and continue the policy down the track. So with that, I'm not going to get into the details, but I want to encourage you to support this, knowing that you are the relief valve if it doesn't work. And, oh, by the way, one of the things that you'll hear a lot is some of the folks for who have concerns are those who have off-road vehicles, construction vehicles, or farm vehicles. And if you pay close attention to the law, you'll see that they're exempted. So we have some there. The last thing I will say, Mr. Chair, is I believe you each got, and I think probably by email, a report that was released today by the Clean Fuels Advisory Committee, their final recommendations, which they, by the way, recommend that we do this. And there's, it's worth reading. And it's, I think it's a good report. I was impressed with it when I read it. It's not a bunch of wild-eyed liberals who put it together. It's fairly balanced, and it includes people like representatives from Daimler, Northwest Natural, the Oregon Business Association, Roseburg Forest Products, Intel, Waste Management, and Timber Products Company, a large independent timber company in my area. So there's some thought that's gone into this by people that have far more expertise than we do and have spent more time on it. And their solid recommendations are Oregon should move forward on this effort. It's an important thing to do. Mr. Chair, I thank you for the opportunity to testify today and would be happy to answer any questions that people might have.
Thank you, Senator Beyer. Are there any questions for the Senator?
I do. Thank you, Senator Beyer, for your testimony. You are the chief co-sponsor of Senate Bill 324. And there's a dash 3 amendment, which is a gut and stuff of that bill. Are you also the chief co-sponsor of that bill?
I am not chief sponsor of that. I am aware of it. It is the work of the DEQ and various stakeholders trying to reach some consensus on making it, if you will, better.
I will follow up, please.
Follow up.
I will state that in this body, I have had a bill for many years now on transparency, which says you put your name on an amendment so we know where they come from, so that the audience can tell where those bills come from. When you do a gut and stuff, when you get a bill that says remove lines 6 through 27 and end pages 2 through 4, the whole process begins again and the bill is changed. You talk about the relief valve, if you will, but in the gut and stuff, there is no relief valve. It's been removed. And we can be called into session to do anything we want, but the fact is that how long would this have to go on before there would be a change in the cost to Oregonians that would be to the level of calling a special session to provide for this relief valve?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, I think you'll hear, and I would encourage you to, I think Mr. Peterson can address some of that, but I think that the intent was to provide more certainty. And there's more there in dealing with that. But it's certainly a fair question to ask. I was not the drafter of those. My intent was just to take the sunset off and move us forward. Most important point to me is providing certainty to those who are willing to brave the frontier and invest to try and improve things.
Well, I will state that when the word certainty or incentive comes up in my vernacular, certainty means a government mandate that you will have a prescribed monopoly, and incentives means that the government will be providing you with money. And we are the government, but we the people are the ones that provide the dough.
Senator Olson, just so everybody's aware, the Dash 3 amendment has been worked on by the governor's office and my office. So the Dash 3 amendments were posted, I believe, 3 days after the bill, the underlying bill, and the amendments strike are an attempt to address some of the concerns about 324 in its original form, and of course the department is here to explain further.
Thank you.
So
once again, it goes to transparency. Who wrote it? It's easy to put your name on it. There's plenty of paper.
And I support your
he does
your
yes.
rule to he to, does. To require that.
Well, we got that. We got
that. I also
Senator,
know that
I think that's a different forum.
And Mr. Chair, I also understand that we just received a dash four. So it seems to me that this is a bill, let's say, in action, working, and we may not have seen the final draft of any amendments.
Right.
Very good point.
Yeah. Any other questions for Senator Beyer? Thank you for your testimony and bringing this measure to us. So next up, Senator Farioli.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Ted Farioli, District 30. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, when people talk to an investment counselor, they're given a prospectus. And somewhere buried in the small print in the prospectus, it says that past performance may be no indicator of future performance. And it's meant to raise a question mark in the mind of the person contemplating an investment. In this instance, I will say that our past performance is probably indicative of our future performance. So I'm going to just remind members of a little of our past performance. At one point in time, after 9/11, Oregon determined that it wanted to have interoperability between first responders, firefighters, police officers, and emergency technicians. And so our initial study of the interoperability problem produced a program to create interoperability, and the ultimate cost of that program was estimated to be hundreds of millions of dollars. And wisely, the legislature did not proceed with that interoperability prospectus because the investment was far too much money and indeterminate in its total cost. So we shied away from that. As a matter of fact, there are a dozen or so IT projects that Oregon has engaged in. You know, one of them was the DMV project, which was a $40 million failure. I probably don't need to remind people of Cover Oregon. That's $250 million. In not one of those instances that I remember did the safety valve of a special legislative session ever come into play. We just went off the cliff. And so I would urge you to be very skeptical if people tell you that or ask the question, what could go wrong? You know, this is, we're just making a market and distorting a market and dealing with market forces beyond the controls of the Oregon State Legislature. We're dabbling in international issues. But what could go wrong? And if something does go wrong, well, we'll just come in and do, you know, a special session. I just would tell you that when the Betsy sucked $500 million out of the general fund because of our over-enthusiastic incentives that we created for green power, that cost was transferred to every Oregonian who turns on a light switch. And we had to, not during special legislative session, but we had to come in and deal with the Betsy credit because it was over generous and underthought, and the unintended consequences were massive. Started to eat into K-12 funding and every other important program that Oregonians expect from us. I would submit to your consideration that Oregon is the capital of unintended consequences, and what I provided is even not even a partial list of the policy failures that this body is engaged in, all wrapped around the big idea, the great initiative, but no real detail. We're about to embark on distortions of the energy market that could cause gas prices to go up by a few cents or a few dollars. And no one can tell you what is the cost. They'll just tell you that, oh, there's a safety valve, and trust us. Colleagues, this is not something we should enter into lightly or ill-advisedly or in a hurry. You know, we're going to be in this building till July. And I would suggest to you, if somebody wants to run this bill this week, they are doing Oregonians a grave disservice because there are too many unanswered questions. With the chairman's permission, I'd like to read into the record just a brief statement, and I'll do so Please. As quickly as I can. Senator Edwards, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee, you know, Oregon has been implementing climate-friendly energy policies for three decades. We are one of the lowest emitting states in the U.S. With a population of approximately 1%, we emit about 0.68%. That's 6/800ths of a percent of the total emissions of the United States because we have access to low-carbon resources, water-powered electricity, 94% of which of our power comes from hydropower, clean natural gas, or wind. So with a carbon footprint that is the fifth smallest in the U.S., there is no real imperative for us to take action quickly when we should be taking action thoughtfully. Per capita, as I said, we're in the top or in the bottom five for lowest carbon emissions in the U.S. We know that the low-carbon fuel standard disproportionately hurts low-income families, senior citizens, and rural Oregonians because we know it will raise gas prices. Even the DEQ admits that it will. It is a hidden gas tax, and it is being sold as a way to reduce carbon emissions, when in practice, fuel producers don't have to lower the carbon content of their fuels. They just have to pay to play. Both sides of the aisle claim to believe creating family wage jobs and helping rural Oregon should be our top priorities. But Senate Bill 324 will hurt those same Oregonians, many outside of Portland who do not have access to public transportation, have to drive long distances to work and school, and can't afford an expensive fuel-efficient vehicle to offset the higher prices at the gas pump. Colleagues, I believe that Senate Bill 324 embodies issues that we should deliberate carefully and discuss, but I would urge this committee not to take any precipitous action before we know the true costs of what we're proposing to do with the market distortion that we're calling the low-carbon fuel standard. Today, when I look at the list of folks who can participate in this market, there are only two producers in the state of Oregon who will benefit directly because they're producers. The rest are corporations who sell fuel who will be forced into a market of trading credits. Colleagues, I would suggest to you that the best example of what not to do is what we did with the Betsy. You know, I was wildly enthusiastic about the prospect of new jobs and new energy creation in the mid-Columbia area of eastern Oregon. And today when you drive through there, the principal feature of the landscape is, in fact, what we incented, which was wind power. And it's been extremely successful and extremely valuable. And it was also, to Oregon taxpayers, extremely expensive. We have mandates for consuming that power. And it has no doubt contributed to the reduction of carbon loads, but it has added tremendous expense, and in some cases, in communities where people can least afford to pay the additional expense. That is precisely what's proposed here. And I would ask you, please, if you wish to consider this issue, do so thoughtfully and carefully and not on somebody's political timetable. Let's get the answers before we take the action. As I mentioned, there are more than enough examples of our enthusiasm and our frailties in the immediate past with some of the massive public policy failures that I've already outlined. So, Mr. Chair, with that, I'll take any questions that members have if they wish to ask them.
Thank you, Senator Farioli. Any questions or follow-up?
Talk them into stunned silence again, Mr. Chair. Thanks very much. And if you haven't seen this,
just holding our tongues,
meme, I will deliver them to your dais so that they can be shared with the members.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Next up, we have, let's see, the panel from the DEQ, Director Peterson.
Yep.
To explain the bill and the dash three amendments.
Good afternoon, Chair Edwards, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dick Peterson. I am Director of the Department of Environmental Quality. And with me today is Corianne Wind. She's an air quality planner with DEQ, has done primarily the main work on this, on the rule that we developed. And she's here to answer any questions if I'm not able to answer them. I'm here today to provide testimony and support for Senate Bill 324 to lift the sunset on the Clean Fuels Program. In 2009, the legislature passed House Bill 2186, authorizing the Environmental Quality Commission to adopt rules to implement a clean fuel standard in Oregon. On January 7th of this year, after much stakeholder input and thoughtful consideration, the EQC delivered a program to this legislature that works. In the past 5 years, we have met with stakeholders in an open and collaborative process. We've consulted with over 60 experts in the fuels industry on three different advisory committees to consider how the program should be designed. We received over 700 comments that were considered and used to inform the final rule. With the input we've received from experts and stakeholders, I'm confident that DEQ can implement the clean fuel standard. So how does this program work? The final program is simple, reliable, and predictable. The standards are based on the carbon contents of fuels available in 2015, this year, and then reduced by 10% through 2025. Fuels whose carbon content is higher than the standard generate deficits. Those that are lower generate credits. Like a bank account, the deficits and credits must balance at the end of each calendar year to meet the standard. There are two ways to comply. You can blend gasoline and diesel with biofuels, like ethanol or biodiesel, or you can buy credits from businesses who invest in alternative fuels like natural gas, biogas, propane, or electricity. In 2014, both an Oregon study and a regional study showed that through blending and the use of credits, the standard can be met. I just explained how we got to program implementation and generally how it works. Now I'd like to speak to the bill, Senate Bill 324 and the Dash 3 Amendment. The committee should have before you, or electronically, those amendments and a summary of the amendments. First of all, we believe the program works and meets the statutory requirements. The Dash 3 Amendment, however, is offered to make the program even better. First and foremost, the amendment repeals the sunset and confirms that the program will be implemented between 2015 in 2025. This provides businesses with a certainty to plan for the future compliance with the program and provides a strong signal for long-term investment in the clean fuels market. The amendment provides protection to businesses that may be affected by fuel supply or fuel quality issues, such as construction equipment and watercraft. The amendment will help small businesses by exempting them from having to meet the carbon reduction standards. Small importers will still have to register with the program and report the kinds and amounts of fuel they import, but will not have to change the fuel they supply or purchase credits. The amendment ensures that biodiesel used in Oregon meets the highest fuel quality standards. The amendment will clarify that propane is an alternative fuel that can generate credits in the program. And lastly, the amendment will provide DEQ with clear authority to manage the costs of complying with the program. This will be done by removing the fuel price deferral and giving DEQ the authority to adopt the best cost containment measures, such as managing credits and credit prices for alternative fuels. So in conclusion, I would like to say that I believe the flexibility built into this program will result in the lowest compliance cost. I believe that there is ample monitoring of fuel supply and prices by DEQ to be able to respond to shortages and price spikes. And I believe the EQC, Environmental Quality Commission, will provide the necessary oversight of the agency to ensure the program is operated as designed. With that, I urge you to support Senate Bill 324 and the Dash 3 Amendment, and I'm happy to answer any questions you might have about the program.
Any questions for the director? Actually, why don't we move to the second half of the panel and then to court, or do you need to leave?
No, actually, Senator Edwards, Ms. Wynn is just here to help answer questions.
Great.
Yeah.
Okay.
So.
Okay.
Well, Senator Olson. Thank you, Mr. Peterson. I appreciate your testimony. Question I have, what will be the carbon intensity number that you will set on the 2015 base?
Chair Edwards, Senator Olson, the carbon intensity, and Ms. Wynn can get to the detail of this, but it's based on information that we receive from the importers or the fuel providers about what that carbon intensity is. And so, Corianne, do you want to?
Sure. For the record, my name is Corianne Wind. I work for DEQ. So Chair Edwards and Senator Olson. So there are actually two standards for the low carbon fuel for the clean fuels program. So there's a gasoline standard, and that baseline will be 89.31. That's in grams of carbon dioxide equivalents per megajoule. And then for the diesel standard, the beginning baseline is 87.09.
Thank you. Follow up?
Yeah, follow up.
I either could answer this question. Do you know the current projected base that California is going to come in with when they reach their 10-year period, their 10-year extension? Do you know what the number is they want to reach on their gas and carbon intensity?
Senator Olson, I don't know the answer to that question.
I believe, and we might hear this in testimony,
yep.
We're not certain what the number would be, mm-hmm. but it's very close to what we already are.
Mm-hmm. Chair Edwards, Senator Olson, you'll be able to hear what that is from the California folks.
We have California folks here to testify?
Yeah, they're here today.
Yep. Okay. And then also, one more follow-up. Prescription that we have to protect Oregonians from high fuel prices.
Mm-hmm.
Typically, that's a legislative thing that we do. When you go in to take it into an agency level, that gets a little more scurrilous, if you will. It's a little more not compact and not concise and can be dictated by other outside forces. Do you see that as a possibility happening here?
Chair Edwards, Senator Olson, my directive, and certainly as the Dash 3 amendments are proposed, is to really give DEQ the authority to contain cost in the best way possible. And for me as director, I would say that means to ensure that we watch this this program evolve if the sunset is lifted, and that we absolutely ensure that costs are contained. And it's not about folks can pay more just to make the program work. It really is about cost containment.
Well, one final question, please.
Sure. Go ahead.
We're going to sell credits. Do we know how much it's going to cost? And you figured 6 to 19 cents a gallon increase. Who gets the money? The state doesn't, do they?
Mm-hmm. Chair Edwards, Senator Olson, really it's a market thing. That who gets the money is if someone has a clean fuel that is available for a credit for a purchase, then that purchase is made between who wants to buy it and who wants to sell it. Yes, in the state of Oregon, DEQ, for instance, administrative size, does not get any money from that.
So for clarification, just to make sure that I understand this right,
mm-hmm.
So if a fuel importer, and this is on importers,
mm-hmm.
needs to reduce the carbon intensity of their fuel, their portfolio of fuel that they import, by 1% in a year's time in order to meet the 10% over a 10-year time, then they can do one of two things. They can either blend to reduce the carbon intensity, or they could invest or purchase a credit from somebody else that invested in a technology like an electric vehicle charging station or natural gas fueling infrastructure or something like that. They could get a credit for that as a way to meet their obligation, balancing their deficits and their credits to see whether or not they've met their 1% improvement obligation on an annual basis. Is that, am I understanding that correctly?
Here, Chair Edwards, that is correct.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. Senator Thompson.
Yeah, I got a question. I'm not really sure how to ask. So if this starts in 2015, then we have a targeted of a certain percentage of like ethanol use or some other clean fuel blend. Is there a target you're trying to reach by the end of this time?
Chair Edwards, Senator Thompson, good question. There's a lot of clarity that's asked about that. Really, we don't set a blending requirement at all. It's just a matter of it's a clean fuel requirement. So an importer has to report, did they reduce by a certain amount at the end of the year their carbon content of their fuels? How they go about doing that is how they, however they choose to, either by blending or buying the credit. And the other thing to point out is that the early years are very gradual. I think it's 0.25% the first year, and it doesn't go up percent per year up to the 10%. So it's more expectation for the clean fuel requirement at the tail end of the 10-year period. But no, we don't dictate an amount of blend.
Follow on?
Yeah, follow on.
So the cars that are currently being produced, if 10 years out, the number we're trying to get to, if that was today, will our car engines that are produced today be able to run on those fuels, or will they have to change technology in our engines in order to run? Because right now, if you use a lot of ethanol, you get about five miles per gallon less miles per gallon.
Mm-hmm.
Because of some of the ethanol use. So right now, do you know if our engines would be able to run on those without messing up the engines?
Yep. Chair Edwards, Senator Thompson, this program, it does not change the amount of ethanol that's required in fuels. In fact, that's set statutorily, as I understand it. All this does or provides an opportunity for is to allow importers of fuels that blend to choose a different feedstock of blend that's a cleaner fuel. It's still ethanol, but it comes from a cleaner side. So this does not change the the current requirement for how much ethanol is required to be in vehicles.
I have a question.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dick, in its original conception, I think, you know, the program, when we first talked about this and adopted it in 2009, most of the focus was on ethanol.
Mm-hmm.
But since then, the program has expanded to other alternative fuels. And I wonder if you could say something about that, in order to get us to our goals of reducing the overall carbon that's emitted through our vehicles, we're looking at a variety of transportation fuels.
Mm-hmm.
So what is it that's included in this?
Yes, Chair Edwards, Senator Dambro, the nice thing about this program, and it does give lots of opportunities that are out there. Certainly blending is an opportunity, but when it comes to other transportation fuels, looking to things like natural gas, propane, biogas, methane, electricity, to be able to convert change that dynamic in terms of what people are using to drive vehicles or to fuel their vehicles, this program will look to that as a way of compliance with the Clean Fuel Standard. So it does embrace a much larger look at transportation other than just blending.
We heard from Senator Ferrioli that DEQ is estimating a potential increase in the cost of fuel as a result of this program. Mm-hmm. How did you do those estimates? And my sense is that they're not really big increases, and they're spread out again over 10 years with the bulk coming at the end, if there are any increases. How did you come up with those projections?
Chair Edwards, Senator Dembrough, I'll have Ms. Wind expand on this a little bit, but we relied on experts to do an analysis of that, a couple of them to look at those costs, and that's where we came up with the 4 to 19 cents per gallon possible increase at the end of the program. And so that information is available. I will tell you some of what I'm learning today is that even some of the fuels that are available currently, like propane is being one of them, are cost less right now than what gasoline costs. So that's something to think about, I suppose. And also, I think you may hear from California and some of the work that's going on down there that the cost at the pump is for the increases that they're asking is far below that. But, Corey, I don't know if you have anything more to add.
Sure, Chair Edwards, Senator Burnborough. I would say that then we used information that was done primarily in the states of California and states from Washington. These are studies that looked at what the potential economic impact are. We used those studies analyzed it. We looked at how comparable the assumptions that were done in those studies were to what we think are actually going to occur in the state of Oregon. The estimate of the 4 to 19 cents, that's, you know, an estimate that we were able to extract from those other studies. But, you know, what it doesn't really factor in is that, you know, the potential growth of the clean fuels market. So in as much as some of these alternative fuels are cheaper, you know, there's still somewhat of an uncertainty about what that transformation is going to be. So that's why we presented a range. I think that there's a possibility that, again, depending on how fast and to what extent the market transforms, I think those values could come much lower than those estimates.
For clarification, the 4 to 19 cents that we're talking about, we're not talking about annually, correct?
No.
We're talking about over a 10-year life of the program to get a total 10% reduction in carbon emissions, correct?
Chair Edwards, that's correct.
So, Chair Edwards, it's the 4 to 19 cent represents in the 10th year of the program when a full 10% is actually required.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Senator Przonski.
Since we're talking about gas prices, I just happened to be back in Texas a week before last, and I was at a station that the E85 price was 30 cents a gallon difference than regular unleaded. And I'm just trying to kind of figure this out. I mean, that is considered an alternative fuel. And the studies that you had or the individuals that were going through that map out what type of really difference in pricing you'd actually would see for these alternative fuels. Of course, I don't know, it's going to depend on what the fuel is, but it seems to me, I was somewhat surprised that they would have that much of a difference in price per gallon at the gas pump.
Great.
Chair Edwards, Senator Przonski, 30 cents higher or lower?
Lower. It was like, I think the pricing, this was like $1.91, $1.94 for regular unleaded. And the E85 at this one station is anecdotal, but it was 30 cents less than that.
Yeah, sure. So, Senator Przonski, it's, you know, what you see is a reflection of, you know, ethanol being priced cheaper than gasoline is, you know, in certain states or depending on where your fuels you have available to you, you know, there is a pricing adjustment to be able to, you know, consume those kinds of ethanol. I would say that for the work that we were doing in Oregon, you know, in E85 does require flex fuel vehicles to be able to use it. It's not like any vehicle can take E85. So there is, again, a little consideration of the vehicles that are available in Oregon that can use that, and then being able to supply that, you know, to the general population.
Thanks for the clarification.
Well, thank you very much. You talked about the escalator, the fuel cap or the cost that you'd put on there. It could be 49 cents by in 10 years or 19 cents in 10 years, whatever it is. Can we truly reach our potential, the cap that we want to reach specifically on fuels alone, or is it requiring that we Oregonians buy new vehicles to run on new sources of fuel? For example, electric cars is a basis of to drop our carbon output tremendously, but we only have 2,000 electric cars in Oregon. Mm-hmm. So how are we going to get there? Sure. Because we're not going to do it on biofuels alone.
Yeah, Chair Edwards, Senator Olson. Again, it's an opportunity. Say if a fleet wants to change out to propane or some electric, that's an option for a credit. So there's lots of those options. The thing, there is a price containment methodology in there that says if alternative fuels, clean fuels, are not available to meet the standard, then we can defer the program. That's directly in the rule.
Follow up. By we, yep. Who would it be, the you or?
Yeah, Chair Edwards, Senator Olson. It's in the rule that the EQC just passed. Yep.
Thank you. Any other questions for the panel? Seeing none. Thank you both for being here.
Thank you.
Next, we are going to call up a panel of
fuel car
opponents. No. No. Mr. Russell and Craig Campbell and Paul Romaine.
If you get stuck, my brother-in-law. This is so totally different than Senator. If you get stuck in here, you can turn your gas.
30 seconds. It's giving him a minute.
And I apologize if I mischaracterize your opposition. I'm assuming that you are opponents, but I should let you speak for yourself. So
it's like the Super Bowl when you are interviewing. They were
you are seated on this panel because I'm assuming that you're opponents. So
it was like at the Super Bowl when one of the reporters was talking about the offense, and she was basically saying where they were offensive. And the accent was wrong syllable, so
twice.
And to clarify,
we are not offensive, but we are, and we're not the offense on this either.
And to clarify, as with the panel that will come after you, you each have 15 minutes, but us talking and interrupting and that doesn't, and asking more questions doesn't count against your time. So
never get out.
Oh man, you should.
Well, I know we're not gonna get. I'm telling you, there's no way that we're getting done in the next 58 minutes. So,
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I will attempt to speak with alacrity. Good afternoon. My name is Craig Campbell. I'm here on behalf of AAA Oregon in opposition to Senate Bill 324. We oppose the low carbon fuel standard in the form adopted by the EQC, and hence the oppose the current bill that would eliminate the sunset provision on that for three reasons. The low carbon fuel standard will increase the cost on the motoring public without a commensurate benefit to the motoring public by way of tangible improvements to the transportation system. There's no realistic estimate on how much pump prices might increase, making it difficult to approve a measure without knowing the true economic impact of Oregon drivers. DEQ has indicated that it has adequate off-ramps and that there's always the ability for the legislature to act. AAA would prefer that there would be more certainty and objective evaluation about costs before risking economic strain on Oregon's motorists, where the relief would likely come months after identification and then implementation, even if the legislature were able to come in special session. Two, there's a pervasive effort to adopt policies that disincentivize motorists to use automobiles without thought to who ultimately is adversely affected by those policies and how. And three, we're aware that Oregon is in critical need of investments in its transportation system, and that the low carbon fuel standard debate has become entangled with our ability to successfully achieve a transportation funding package this year. We may be forced to choose between this and a transportation tax increase, and if DEQ's estimate ultimate increase after 10 years of 4 cents to 19 cents per gallon is accurate. And some, of course, will argue that that number underestimates the potential impact. If that same amount was instead adopted as a gas tax at full implementation, that would translate to $184 million per biennium to $874 million per biennium for Oregon's bridges, roadways and highways. There are about 750,000 AAA members in Oregon, and for the most part, they're members because they like our roadside assistance or they use our various other services that they like. Those members represent the full spectrum of Oregonians, from the wealthy to the financially challenged, the young, the old, conservative, liberal, moderate, from every geographic region in the state and reflecting every demographic the state has to offer. The one thing they all share is that they all happen to be motorists. Now, some of them are also bike enthusiasts, or they like to take transit, or they walk, like myself, but they're all motorists. Now, they serve as an excellent bellwether for those Oregonians who collectively own 4 million automobiles in the state and travel 36 billion miles over Oregon's cities, counties, and states every year. Sorry, state roads every year. For Oregon, the automobile is still by far the primary mode that allows people to get to work, school, the doctor's office, the big game, their place of worship, and to the grocery store. So when you are asked to support a policy that it may increase the cost to those critical activities, we ask that you do so not with the exuberance of experimenting with something you hope will benefit the environment, but rather that you do so with the sober evaluation of what extent that policy will help the environment and balance that against whether or not the ultimate benefit is worth the disproportionate impact on someone like a single mother of three living in Klamath Falls who drives a 2004 Chevy Astro that gets 12 miles to the gallon because it's the only thing she could afford at $4,400, or a member of the senior community that is on a fixed income and can't easily translate what they do to an increase or decrease in fuel costs. The low carbon fuel standard adds yet another policy that attempts to add discomfort to the motoring public. That may not be its primary goal, but that is its ultimate effect. It's the sort of policies that have currently prevented highway capacity in Portland to get motorists to use other forms of transportation. The desired result is laudable. Fewer cars on the road means lower emissions. The more people that take public transit, the more sustainable that system is. The more people that bike or walk, the healthier they are. But these positive goals are tainted by policies of negative incentive, and some people in the state simply do not have those other options to use. The fear is that the low-carbon fuel standard, like the constraint on congestion relief, will not have the desired result, but rather will translate into unintended consequences, such as an increase in the cost of operating a vehicle, which makes the passage of a transportation funding effort in the future more difficult, just as the restriction on congestion relief has increased CO2 emissions as cars spend longer time on the road emitting carbon as they sit and stop and go traffic. Many recent initiatives that seek to help the environment start with the program rather than the goal. Now, I've observed over the last several years a number of programs that have been raised as cause celebs for the environmental community, with a goal of being passage of the specific program being put forward. Inevitably, there's a coalition of individuals that gathers together to oppose those programs, like Cap and Trade or the Betsy or the biofuels plants on the Columbia. I think the low-carbon fuel standard is yet another one of those cause celebs. Now, I want to be very clear. The problem is not that the proponents of any of these programs don't have laudable goals. They want to help develop policies that will turn the corner on emissions in the hopes that the stemming of the worst impacts of climate change. But to be equally clear, those who oppose those programs are not by and large against such a goal. It's not the result but the means of achieving it that is the problem. Seldom are those who ultimately oppose the programs meaningfully included in the development of these ideas, nor is their input given weight when they go through the time-consuming but seldom useful process of public input before a state agency. The result, then, is a fight here in the legislature. Something that AAA has been advocating over the last few years as the battle for the low-carbon fuel standard has continued is to stop and take a different approach. Instead of coming up with a program developed in isolation from input outside of the environmental community, why not invite to the table those seen as traditional or potential opponents of such a program to discuss means of achieving the goal? What we've needed in this case is an honest and open dialogue about how to reach the outcomes that the low-carbon fuel standard wishes to achieve, but to do it in such a way that those who oppose it can live with. The end result may be a synergistic solution that achieves more than the recent string of programs can or could achieve, and at least that would be our hope. Now, I know there's a number of people who are here to testify, and my gentleman to the left would like to get going as well, but I want to relay one very quick story. back in 2008, we had come to the realization that we were no longer going to be having transportation highway funding discussions, but now we were talking about all transportation funding discussions dealing with the entire system. We also knew that critical parts of that discussion had to include the environmental community, but we didn't have a good relationship with the environmental community. We were seen as the traditional enemies of the environmental community, and so we went to Gail Ackerman, who at that point in time arranged for us to meet with two representatives of the environmental community, Angus Duncan and Bob Stacey, both of whom had positions of leadership. By getting to know each other personally, we were able to work together to achieve a number of phenomenal things that are coming to fruition even now. But my main point is we would never have been able to achieve those things if we had stayed with our traditional roles of opponents to one another. And so by sitting down at the same table, we were able to achieve a great deal more. So what AAA is asking is, I know in the vernacular of the legislature, asking for a work group or for an interim study is tantamount to trying to kill something through delay. What we're asking for is an opportunity for all the parties to sit together to see if we cannot come up with a solution here, perhaps even this session, to find a way of reaching the goals that the Low Carbon Fuel Standard seeks to achieve, but to do it in a way that works for everyone who's around the table. And hopefully, then everyone in this room is here in support of what we're trying to do rather than mixed between support and opposition. Thank you.
Move to next on the panel, and then we'll open it up for questions.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bob Russell. I'm Vice President of Government Affairs for the Oregon Trucking Associations, and I would like to thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today on Senate Bill 324. And Mr. Chair, just to be clear, yes, we are opposed to Senate Bill 324. Personally, I've been involved in this from the very beginning. The first administrative rule advisory committee that DEQ put together back in about 2010, I sat on that for months and months, and we had day-long meetings, and it was tortuous. And when DEQ went to the Environmental Quality Commission, the Environmental Quality Commission did not adopt the substantive part of the rules. They only adopted the rules for reporting. And that part of the program was then subsequently implemented. So we didn't have any rules for the program. We did a second Rules Advisory Committee, and that resulted in rules that were adopted by the EQC just this last month. And I sat on that as well. I have testified in every legislative hearing on the enabling legislation, House Bill 2186, that was passed in 2009, through all of the bills that are proposed to remove the sunset. In other words, I've been involved in this pretty extensively. And I'm here to tell you that all of those years of involvement have not allayed our concerns at all. Matter of fact, they have significantly increased the concerns. The more I know, the more that we are concerned. And we continue to believe that this program is incomplete, it's problematic, and its potential for success is very, very speculative. Our primary concern from the trucking industry's point of view is the availability and the cost of fuels. I mean, that is one of the primary costs that a trucking company incurs is fuel costs, and it depends on where the price of fuel is, whether that's the highest or the second highest cost that a company incurs. When the EQC adopted the rules in January, there was a major component that had been deleted from the proposed rules that we looked at as the advisory committee, and that is the value for the indirect land use effect. You heard from earlier testimony that there is a number, a carbon intensity number, that's assigned to every fuel. And every fuel has one because it doesn't matter. They all put out some carbon, even electricity. A major component of that is the indirect land use effects. In the rules that we saw, that was set at about 30, which is about roughly a third of the total. You heard that gasoline was 89. The indirect land use effects were 30. All of the indirect land use values were gone from the final rule. So I called Ms. Wynn and said, what is going on? And she says, well, we've deleted them for now. That at some time in the future, we will put indirect land use effect values back into the rule. Well, without those numbers or having no idea what they're going to be, you don't know which fuels will qualify for the standard. So you've got a big hole in the program. When we did the original sunset, the purpose of the sunset, at least the testimony before the legislature in 2009, was that so that DEQ could go away and develop a program, bring it back so that you could understand it before you remove the sunset. By eliminating the indirect land use effect values, there's a big hole. So you have an unknown program, even today. I also believe that there is a common misconception about how this program will work. Some of the discussion so far today sort of further indicates that that is a common misconception. Many people believe that all the oil industry has to do is blend biofuels with petroleum fuel in order to meet the standard. That is not correct. Today's truck engines, many of them, their warranties only allow 5% biofuels. I've attached to my testimony a chart of all of the companies and where they are. Some are 20%, some are 5%, they're all over the board. For a more complete listing of the warranties and what companies will honor, you can go to biodiesel.org and they have a very extensive list. I didn't print it out because it would have been a book. But the bottom line is that if there's more than 5% biodiesel in diesel, then that voids the warranties for many of our engines and many of the significant truck manufacturers. The oil companies are not going to put more than 5% biodiesel in the fuel because they're not going to assume liability for our engines. So at 5%, once they hit 5%, then they have to buy credits. Now, to get in the early years of the program, they can blend biodiesel that has less carbon than the biodiesel that we have today. That's true. So they can blend some fuels, but they can't exceed that 5% by volume. So they're never going to get to the 10% reduction unless they take on the responsibility for our engines, which they're not going to do. By the way, the same problem exists with ethanol, but I don't speak to those folks, Craig Pess. Another issue with the current rules is there's a new provision for a broker, and these people are allowed to buy, sell, or hold these credits. So they don't generate them. They're just like a stockbroker, basically. There are no regulatory provisions in the rules to govern these folks. I thought that we sort of learned about unregulated brokers back in 1929. I think that it's imperative that there be some regulation of these folks, because if they hold the credits, they're speculating, and that will only increase the cost. So there needs to be more thought around the idea of the brokers. The cost, you've heard 4 to 19 cents. You've heard somebody mentioned $1.06. These were all studies that were done not of Oregon's low carbon fuel standard, but of a proposal on Washington and California's. Those studies dealt primarily with gasoline and ethanol. From our point of view, diesel is a little more important. The California Trucking Associations did a study of California's low carbon fuel standard, and they concluded that it would raise the cost of diesel down there by $1.47 a gallon. I think Mr. Campbell put that in perspective for you. The Jobs and Transportation Act, although it increased other things, it had a 6-cent gas tax in it. It raised about $300 million a year. So if you see 6 cents a gallon, 19 cents a gallon, whatever it is, those are huge numbers in actual cost imposition. And I really think that they're not going to be 4 to 19 cents. It's going to be something greater than that.
We're approaching.
I'll try to finish up real quick. One of the concerns that we have about increasing the cost of diesel fuel is the trucking industry currently transports about 75% of tons of freight in this state, and the forecast is that our market share is going to increase. It's not going to go down. If we increase the cost of trucking, we're going to have an impact on Oregon's economy. It's going to be difficult for producers to reach markets that are distant markets and be competitive. And it's all also going to increase the cost of goods that Oregonians buy. So I think that that needs to be considered very carefully, because I think the risks are very great. We talked a bit about the off-ramps, and there are three off-ramps that are they're in the rules that were adopted in January. And one of them is in case of an emergency like a natural disaster. I hope that never happens. If it does, I think the last thing we're going to have to worry about is how much biofuels we've got in our fuel. But so the second one, it was designed to deal with the supply. But what it really does is it deals with the credits. Are the credits available? Well, are the brokers holding the credits? I don't know. So I'm not real comforted that you're talking about credits and not the actual supply of fuel. The third one was to deal with price. It's a 12-month rolling average, and there can be significant price spikes. I understand that the Dash 3s provide new direction to DEQ, but what I would suggest to you is that is another huge hole in the program. What are the off-ramps? What are we actually doing to protect consumers? We're just telling DEQ to do it. I'm sorry, I like DEQ a lot, but that doesn't give my industry a lot of comfort. I also would like to point out that the trucking industry has done a significant amount to reduce emissions from our heavy trucks. On page 4 of my testimony, there is everything's listed. That's a lot of effort that we've done over the last couple of decades. We've reduced 95% of the particulates based on our 2007 engines. 95% of the NOx. We've increased the fuel efficiency. We're continuing to increase it. Daimler Freightliner participated in what's called the Super Truck program. They got a grant from EPA. They're going to release their Super Truck in March of this year at the Mid-America Truck Show. That truck has double-digit mileage. Now, that may not sound such a big deal, but our average right now is 6 miles to the gallon. So if you get to double digits, and you're saving a lot of fuel, but you're also reducing a lot of carbon. I would also like to reiterate that you could eliminate all of the carbon, and there's more detail in my testimony, but you could eliminate all the carbon that Oregon puts out and not have any impact whatsoever on the problem. From our perspective, that's unfortunate, because if we're going to go through all this pain and agony, we ought to at least have a program that significantly reduces carbon. We're not flat Earth people. We acknowledge climate change, and we also acknowledge that we need to do our part to reduce carbon emissions. Unfortunately, we don't think this is the way to do it. We support Mr. Campbell's suggestion that we get some folks together and see if we can't come up with some better ideas. We have some better ideas, and because of that, we would ask that you vote no. And sorry I took so long.
I was just wondering if Mr. Romaine sold his time credits to IBM, because you guys both went way over.
I'm getting.
Go ahead,
enough,
but
I'm old enough so that if the money's there, I'm gone.
So. I'm sure there's a broker in the audience that would give.
Yeah, anybody want to broker this deal? I'm willing.
Go ahead,
Mr. Chair.
Sorry, I wasn't trying to cut you off. I'm being sensitive to the time, and I know that
I appreciate
Paul still has to testify. So, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Paul Romaine. I'm an attorney in Portland at the Romaine Group with my daughter Danelle, and we're representing the Oregon Fuels Association. We changed our name last year from the Petroleum Association to the Fuels Association because we sell all of these biofuels. We sell regular petroleum. We sell anything that works. We're in the business. I want to read a quote from an economic report start off. It's a quote. Eco Northwest found that over the next 15 years, projects would create over 2,100 new jobs, boost economic output by $178 million, and cut energy costs by $60 million, end quote. That's a quote. You might think that this is a position of the LCSF supporters, but in fact, this is a quote from an Oregon Department of Energy report in 2006 raving about the Betsy. So let's look at the facts. The Low Carbon Fuel Standard is not a blending program. It's designed to make gasoline and diesel so expensive that consumers have no choice but to switch to alternative fuels. And I cite to you Michael Bernstein, the Director of Renewable Low Carbon Fuels from British Columbia, August 28 of 2014, I'm getting old, who said at one of these painful DEQ advisory meetings that Bob and I and others sat through, this is his quote, and I think that I'm also hearing a little bit of conversation that people have to realize that under this regulation, compliance through your own product, if it's a petroleum product, is not ever going to be possible in the long run. It's only possible in the short run while the alternative fuels like the biodiesels and the ethanol can be blended in. But you're going to reach a limit, and you are going to have to buy credit someday. So early days, you don't like the idea. I understand that. I hear the same thing from our suppliers. But the reality is, sooner or later, everybody who sells petroleum is going to have to get credit from somebody who sells a lower carbon product or get into the business themselves. So the other one, Angus Duncan wrote a wonderful op-ed piece, actually. He's a good friend, and we're miles apart on policy, but he's a great guy. But he was very truthful in the Oregonian. He said the cost savings come basically when everybody goes to electric vehicles. You'll save a ton of money if everybody had an electric vehicle. But that means everybody has to have an electric vehicle, and most of them have to get some at least decent mileage. We already have a blending program. Our gasoline right now in Oregon is E10. That's 10% ethanol. And our diesel is B5, 5% biodiesel. Cellulosic ethanol is supposed to be the holy grail. It has not been developed in commercial quantities yet. People are still working on it. And in fact, in 2012, the oil companies were mandated. This was a program back around 2006, 2007, where EPA was to mandate blending of cellulosic ethanol. In fact, the mandate in 2012 was 1 billion gallons of cellulosic ethanol. Oil companies didn't blend 1 billion. EPA fined them. They go to court to say we can't be forced to blend that which doesn't exist. The court said exactly that. You can't be forced to blend. You have to go back, EPA, and determine exactly how much was available. So they went from 1 billion in 2012. They said, all right, blend 2 million with an M. gallons of ethanol. At the end of the year, they recalculated. It was 880,000 gallons. It doesn't exist in commercial quantities. The World Resource Institute, a liberal global research organization based in Washington, D.C., in fact, Sam Adams, the former mayor of Portland, just went to work as their head, just released a report. It was released on Thursday. That urges Western governments to reconsider reliance on biofuels. This is from the New York Times story. Western governments had made a wrong turn in energy policy by supporting the large-scale conversion of plants into fuel and should reconsider that strategy, according to a new report from a prominent environmental think tank. Turning plant matter into liquid fuel or electricity is so inefficient that the approach is unlikely ever to supply a substantial fraction of the global energy demand, the report found. It added that continuing to pursue this strategy, which has already led to billions of dollars of investment, is likely to use up vast tracts of fertile land that could be developed to help feed the world's growing population. Some types of biofuels do make environmental sense, the report found, particularly those made from wastes like sawdust, tree trimmings, and corn stalks. But their potential is limited, and these fuels should probably be used in airplanes for which there is no alternative power source that could reduce emissions. This is quote, I would say that many of the claims for biofuels have been dramatically exaggerated, unquote, said Andrew Steer, president of the World Resources Institute, a global research organization based in Washington that is publishing the report. Quote, there are other more effective routes to get to a low-carbon world, end quote. Now, others are going to go into more specifics but this is what we know about the California program that everybody keeps touting about. And, you know, I actually went to school in Berkeley, which might account for a number of things but in my behavior. But we had a guy that used to stand on a corner going like this all the time. And everybody would come up to him and say, what are you going to do? What are you doing? With snapping your fingers. And he goes, I'm scaring away the elephants. And they go, well, that's stupid. There's no elephants in Berkeley. And he goes, see, it's working. That's the same thing with the California program. It began in 2010. It ran for 3 years with mandated reductions of a quarter, then a half, then 1%. It was frozen in 2013 by a court, not over the substance of the program. It was a procedural freezing. Their carbon number for gasoline in 2020, their objective in 2020 is 89.26. That's from their most recent report published by the staff on the rule that they are readopting. It's 89.26. That is a 10% reduction from their base number, which was around 99. The Oregon base carbon number for gasoline, as you heard from DEQ, is 89.31. Our program is supposed to start where California is supposed to end. Diesel's even worse. The California baseline for diesel is 102.82. That's from their reg, and drops to 92.54 in 2020 and beyond. Our diesel starting number is 87.09. That's our B5. We are starting at a number that's 5.45 grams less than where California ends. The Oregon program, frankly, is an absolute failure if it doesn't raise the price of gasoline and diesel considerably. If it simply mandates blending and the fuel to blend is available, works, and is not cost prohibitive, why is there a credit buying program? Does anyone truly believe that the cost of buying credits or blending high-priced fuels will not be passed on to the consumer? We talked a little bit about exemptions earlier. And where do they come from? You can exempt somebody from using the fuel, but if the fuel that they're supposed to use doesn't exist or is considerably higher priced because it's in short supply somewhere or it has to be trucked in from somewhere, what kind of an exemption is that? You have to assume that most everybody has to be able to use that which you mandate. I'm going to end. Most people think that's a good thing. In just a second here, but I want you to remember the Betsy. Here's what the Oregonian said about it in 2014. An investigation by the Oregonian found that state employees originally lowballed projected costs of the program. Two, the legislature tried time and time again to stop blatant abuses of the program. Three, lawmakers first reduced what they saw was unnecessary incentives and eventually killed the program altogether. Four, nonetheless, state taxpayers are stuck with a long hangover of outstanding credits. Five, how many jobs from Oregon's green energy initiatives? No one knows. The question is whether lessons were learned at all. Thank you. Be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, gentlemen. Questions? I have a few questions, but go ahead.
This is just for y'all to get back to us at some point. It seems to me maybe there's another way to get to where we want to go.
Yeah,
I've heard you talk about it, but the thing is, what is it? If you can bring us white papers as to what you think are alternatives, understand you haven't been at the table, understand you want to have a work group, but I'd like to kind of know where you're thinking we should be heading to achieve these goals.
Be happy to.
Love to.
Well, and so to that same end, I mean, it's been my understanding that there's been a lot of public process in this. And, Craig, you said that we haven't been involved. Were you not a part of any work group discussions? I mean, I know Mr. Russell's been involved, and he said he's been very involved, and there's been an extensive process leading up to the DEQ rules that were adopted on the 7th. So is that not true, or
Yes, there has been periods where AAA has been actively involved at the table, but with absolutely no results in the end result. That's the real problem. We've been invited to the table. Thank you for participating, and thank you for your input. And now we're going to do what we were going to do in the first place, which is what the major concern is. It's meaningful input into the process that is our concern.
Okay. So you've been involved. Your recommendations haven't been heeded. Have none of them been heeded, or just some have been heeded and not? But you still oppose the program.
Mr. Chair, Paul Romaine for the record, if I could answer that. We were invited to the table to help DEQ try and implement a low-carbon fuel standard. It was not a table where we were going to discuss alternative ways of getting to the results that you might be able to get by other means of lowering the carbon content of fuel. It was how to implement this program.
Now,
and
I have to disagree a little bit, because the 2009 legislation, which I was very involved with the existing price cap, I mean, that was my the PAD 5 region variance and everything. That was my attempt at that time during the 2009 legislative session, working with Senator Dingfelder, working with Senator Metzger, and working with Representative Cannon. Of those, of the four of us, that was my requirement. As soon as we got it passed, I started to see, you know, some deficiencies with it, and in fact, the department has developed a different path forward for us that doesn't include that same mechanism. So I'm just trying to, you know, the current price off-ramp mechanism that's being proposed is very different than the legislation in 2009. So it seems to me from the outside, and I haven't been a part of those advisory committee meetings, it seems to me that significant changes in the program have been contemplated and have been brought into play.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee,
hear what you want to talk?
No, go ahead. I've been accused of sucking the air out of a room periodically. But it's a different thing to be invited to a table to try and implement a particular program, and actually looking at and you were correct, that off-ramp that was proposed, while well-meaning, the idea, we understood the idea, it was just how are you going to do it? It's really not going to work. Really what's happened, if you look at the current off-ramp, which is just basically punting it back to DEQ to make sure there's sufficient credits, in fact, a question comes up at this point is, unless DEQ starts holding credits, how do you develop a credit market if you don't act as a broker? In effect, and how do you, in effect, act as a broker without making money for the state? And in effect, if you are making money for the state, acting as a broker, don't you have a problem right now with, in effect, using this bill to get money to the state, creating a vote issue, which we would love to have you have at this point? But there are just a lot of things. I think what Mr. Campbell has been talking about is, aside from a low carbon fuel standard, is there another way that you can go where you want to go without risking the great increases in price that our economists believe will be there? And again, I realize this is my economist can beat up your economist scenario, but which happens all the time. The problem with economic analysis is it depends on the inputs. Whatever you put into the equation, that's going to determine the output. So if you put in wild assumptions, you're going to get wild outputs. We need to have a brokered deal where the legislature participates, where people sit down and kind of go through rationally and thinks about this stuff. I mean, right now, you're imposing a program, if this goes through, where we're starting our carbon number where California's trying to get with gasoline. We're starting well below where California's trying to get with their diesel. And I'm assuming that everybody's using the same inputs and stuff on this stuff. Otherwise, the claim by DEQ that they're basically deferring a lot to California on analysis of all this would be terribly false.
Well, I'm going to check on the carbon content tables. I've been told that by the end of the program, by the end of the 10 years, ours and California's would match. And
not according to the published.
Okay, I'm going to find out about that.
So we'll be hearing from California.
Yeah, and we will be hearing from California if we give them any time. I would love to. I mean, we can do this for another, you know, hour, but we do need to move on because I think they're heading back to California tonight, and we have people more than 100 miles here. So
we are all in the building. So if you have any further questions,
okay. Thank you.
Are we done?
Yes, you're done. Next, we have folks from California, Jack Katowski from the California Air Resources Board, and Dr. Sonia Ye from the Institute of Transportation Studies at UC Davis. Thank you for your patience.
Yes, it's quite challenging to sit there and hear about the California program. So thank you, Chair and Senators, for the opportunity to speak here today regarding California's low carbon fuel standards, our experiences, and how we can work together.
State your name for the record, please.
My name is Jack Kotusky. I'm Assistant Chief of the Industrial Strategies Division at the Air Resources Board. Before I actually start my comments, I'd like to take a minute to echo a couple of the director's points. The California and the Oregon low carbon fuel standard programs are very similar, and at their core, they're pretty straightforward. There's a declining standard. Regulated parties can meet that standard by selling cleaner, lower carbon fuel, or blending their fuel with cleaner fuel, or they can buy credits from somebody who sold cleaner fuel. And that is the basics. And the idea is to develop a diversified fuel pool, transform the fuel pool, and it's a market-based system that has both sound policy, economic and environmental policy overtones. So we think it we're excited to be here to talk about the program. So a little bit of the background, LCFS in California is part of a comprehensive suite of programs that we have to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions. It focuses on accelerating the introduction and advancement of clean fuels, and that we believe must occur in the fuel sector to achieve our long-term climate goals. LCFS is performance-based and fuel-neutral. The standard creates healthy market competition between fuels, producers of fuels that solely based on the carbon intensity or emissions per unit of transportation energy of the fuel. The life cycle perspective is what makes this fuel neutral, so we include the emissions associated with the production, the transportation of a given fuel. So California adopted its program, approved the regulation in 2009, has been cited, with a goal of getting a 10% reduction in the carbon intensity by 2020 from a 2010 baseline. In the 5 years since the original adoption, the program's proven effective in attracting cleaner fuels to California despite a fair amount of regulatory uncertainty created by legal challenges. Basically, I would say the program is working as we intended it to work 5 years ago. Regulated parties as a whole continue to over-comply with the regulation, generating excess credits for future compliance. Through the third quarter of last year, the regulated parties have complied every quarter, over-complied, and banked about 40% more credits for future compliance than needed. So some interesting little examples of the success. 170 biofuel facilities have voluntarily opted into the program to supply low-carbon fuel into California. The ethanol supplied to California gasoline has continued to get cleaner as companies respond to the lower carbon fuel standard by finding newer ways to produce lower carbon intensity ethanol. Renewable diesel, and I want to differentiate what was heard before, renewable diesel versus biodiesel. They're both made from the same feedstocks, but through a different method. And biodiesel may have some limitations on warranty. A limit of 5% was cited, although the vast majority limit put a limit of 20% on, and some put no limits on now. But renewable diesel has no such limit, and renewable diesel can be mixed very interchangeably and used throughout the diesel market. And it's increased in California from several years ago. We actually did see no renewable diesel several years ago. To right now, it's about 3% of all diesel sold in California, and it's mixed and used. We expect that to go up significantly. Renewable natural gas has increased, not just natural gas being used as a fuel, as was talked about before, but renewable natural gas has increased about four times in the last several years, and we expect it to quadruple again as folks like dairy digesters and municipal solid waste facilities learn that they can capture their methane, clean it up, and sell it at a profit as a transportation fuel. So I'd like to transition to talk just a minute about the legal challenges which have come up a little bit. The program has weathered several of them. And generally, ARB has prevailed in these lawsuits. In a federal lawsuit regarding whether the LCFS program violated the Commerce Clause, the Ninth Circuit Court said it did not facially discriminate. Subsequently, the full Ninth Circuit Court denied a petition for rehearing on the and then subsequently the plaintiff's petition to the Supreme Court, but that was also denied. So in the federal on the federal side, we have prevailed in all those efforts. On the state side, as was mentioned, we had some procedural issues, and in a lawsuit in 2010 related to our California Environmental Quality Act and our California Administrative Procedures Act. And so those state lawsuits have frozen us at the 1% level. And that was pending a readoption of our program. And so that's why we're in the process of our readoption. We're basically trying to, we're readopting to correct the legal concerns that were raised. We're basically looking at lessons learned we got from the first 5 years of the program, offering some additional flexibility and credit opportunities, and updating critical technical information that we've learned. So the one, I could talk about a number of different areas on that, but I know you're pressed for time. I'll just talk about one aspect of the readoption, and that is the compliance curve. Because we have been frozen at this 1% level, we took a fresh look and analyzed fuel supplies and said, will this fuel be available? Can this work in the California market? What's the potential fuel supplies and their growth? And we found the potential fuel supplies and the growth potential to be very robust. And there's been some studies that folks have quoted, and I think Sonia will also refer to some of those studies. But basically, there's enough confidence on our part that we readopted the 10% level in 2020. We're proposing to readopt the 10% level in 2020. So we're going to move from 1% that we're currently to 10% by 2020. We are smoothing out that curve a little bit, ramping it up a little slower to accommodate for the stalled time that we've had. But the bottom line is we're confident in those fuel supplies being available. So I'd like to close by emphasizing why harmonizing the clean fuel programs between our jurisdictions is useful. We have heard from some folks that this will just create a competition among fuels and this will make it even harder for any of us. We don't believe that to be true for a second. We think a bigger market offers greater investment opportunity. The fuel supply is there. What is needed is the investment opportunity. People need to build the facilities and build the infrastructure to make sure the transportation fuel can handle it. Adopting similar program also reduces the administrative burdens for both regulated parties. So with that, we appreciate the opportunity to share our lessons learned and to work in partnership with Oregon. We've done that in the past. We look forward to doing that in the future. Together, we can help expand and accelerate cleaner, viable economic fuels of tomorrow. I guess the last thing I would add is I've heard a lot just in the last couple of testifiers about mainly concerns, fears, if you want to call it that, of the unknown. The California program is designed to match, or the Oregon program is designed to match our California program. They're not identical, but they're, you know, right in line. They're synergistic. We're 5 years into this program. The impact on our program at this point is, and Sonia could talk about this better, but less than a penny a gallon. If we'd looked at some of the worst-case naysayers that we've seen, and some of them were just quoted, we would have expected price increases of several dollars per gallon. We're not seeing that. The fuels are available. Investment in the fuels is needed. Leadership is needed. Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Yeh?
Can we go through the panel?
Sure.
Okay.
Thank you.
Chair, Senators, good afternoon. It's an honor and a pleasure to speak in front of you. I'm Dr. Sonia Ye, a senior researcher at the Institute of Transportation Studies, University of California, Davis. I've been involved with the design, implementation, and the monitoring of the LCFS program in California since 2007. The purpose of me speaking here is twofold. One, the first is to briefly recap the impasse of LCFS. Second is to provide some information about the recent report published by the International Council on Clean Transportation entitled Potential Low Carbon Fuel Supply to the Pacific Coast Region of North America. In our latest twice a year annual review of the low carbon fuel standard published by the Institute of Transportation Studies, University of California, we found that industry has exceeded the mandated greenhouse gas emission reduction requirement by roughly 70% through the first 4 years. That's a little bit updated from your 40%. Even though the initial requirements are modest, only 1% reduction in carbon intensity. What is especially notable and promising, as you heard from Jack from Air Resources Board, is that the LCFS program involves active participation from a full range of fuel industries, including the petroleum industry, biofuel, natural gas, renewable natural gas, and electric sector. The LCFS has stimulated significant innovations in greenhouse gas reductions and investments in low carbon fuels and low carbon technologies in California and elsewhere. The credit price in the LCFS has fluctuated from $10 per credit to $80 per credit, but stabilized to about $25 per credit in the last 6+ months. This translates to roughly 1/3 of 1 cent per gallon of gasoline used for blending in 2014. However, most people probably don't know that because LCFS is revenue neutral, it lowers lowers the cost of low carbon fuels by an equal amount. Therefore, the impact of the carbon cost on the blended fuel is zero. And this is explained in more detail in the status review that I attached in with this statement. Moving forward, we see from various reports, including the biofuel white paper published by our institute, the recent report from the ICCT report that I just mentioned, as well as the impact assessment studies published by the Air Resources Board in the Washington State, there are ample opportunities and upside economic and environmental benefits to continue support for the adoption of low-carbon fuels, particularly within the Pacific Coast region, to incentivize biofuel development and production to take advantage of locally available feedstock that will provide economic co-benefits. The recent ICCT study, which we participated by providing technical review and support, essentially found that low carbon fuel supply could be sufficient to replace over 1/4 of the gasoline and diesel used by vehicles in the Pacific Coast region by 2030. Low carbon fuels can reduce the overall carbon intensity of on-road transportation fuels in the region by 14 to 20% by 2030. And decarbonization goals do not require a dramatic breakthrough in any one particular technology. Many different technologies exist today and are emergent that can be developed for similar savings in greenhouse gas emissions. The most important take-home message is that the LCFS is technology neutral, as you heard a couple of times. This means that its compliance does not depend on the success or the failure of a single feedstock or a single fuel type. Rather, the combination of credit prices and cost containment mechanisms ensure the market provides sufficient incentives for investment at reasonable cost. Good policy design of the program is essential for the success of decarbonization goal that the PCC states aspire to. Based on our experience and our observation is in the past 4 years, as the previous speaker from the CARB has demonstrated, the industry has responded to the policy beyond requirements. To conclude, to move beyond our use of high carbon fuels that have high impacts on the environment and on the climate. It's our view that important policy strategies will be needed to continue to provide financial incentive to encourage investment, mobilize resources, especially local resources, and to entrepreneurial experiment to level the playing field based on fuel's environmental performance. Policies are also needed to create a guaranteed market to resume private investment. My last point, but not the least, and the reason we're here today is to recognize the importance of policy certainty to ensure all stakeholders in Oregon are committed to reduce greenhouse gas emissions from its economy, including transportation, vehicle, and fuel use. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions of the committee? Yes, Senator Thompson.
Chair Edwards, thank you. The panel before mentioned that your carbon number you're targeted for in 2020. What is your target number?
Yeah, I'll have to say that your Oregon staff's a little better prepared with the precise numbers than I am. I don't have those numbers at my disposal right now, but roughly they're in the high 90s right now and the high 80s when we're getting it in the 2020 timeframe.
Right. So, I mean, it would seem to me like we're kind of there now. We're kind of at those numbers already because we've done the blending and we're using the 5% ethanol and those kind of numbers already. Seems to me if you're in the 90s, you started without the blending and all those things. So you've done the easy part as far as blending the fuel and those kind of things. Well, how do you get, if you're at that level now, how do you get to the next 10% or 8%? How do you drop your carbon numbers by 8? Do you think it'll be as easy as you've done it now, or is now when you're going to get into the more credits and that part of the?
So yeah, you know, system. That's a good question. Let me start by just making a point that I hadn't looked at the two numbers between the two programs precisely before. So this is catching me off of a. You know, well, fortunately, the other panel went long, so I had the chance to think about it for a little bit. But
you're still ahead of me, though.
My understanding is the two numbers are apples and oranges. And in that, although the programs are very consistent in how they're set up and the basic structure, they're not precisely the same. And some of the numbers may be exactly. So if you wanted to do rough numbers, you couldn't, for example, say that, well, California was at 100 and Oregon was at 90. You couldn't say that Oregon was 90% cleaner because the modeling and other work that goes into using the baseline and how the oil production is calculated internally, the crude supplies to the state are different. So I don't think the statement is fair to say that Oregon today is where California is going to end up. You have a little bit more biofuel than we have, but we have more renewable diesel than you do. We both have 10% ethanol. So there are some differences. Your crude supply is probably different than ours, and in the span of 30 minutes, I can't tell you whether you're cleaner or dirtier or the same. But I think the point of the program is that are we going to move the transportation fuel or not? Are we going to try and get, you know, California's program is trying to get a cleaner fuel than what we have on our baseline. We're trying to get 10% reduction off that baseline. As a consequence of that, get greenhouse gas reductions, get the energy diversity and the energy diversity and energy security that comes with that. So the baselines are something we can look at and we can deal with, but I think that argument brought up is a little apples and oranges. I think Sonia wants to weigh in. Let me make one more statement. And your question really, though, got back to how are we going to get where we're going to go? And there was some mention of of, you know, you've got to look at fuels that will work in your transportation sector, and we wholeheartedly agree. There's not something where we went through and said, oh, we're going to completely transform the program through the low carbon fuel standard. We have, and I think this is the beauty of the program, we believe we are working towards a diversified fuel pool. So it's not going to be gasoline and diesel and driven by the whims, the global whims really, of gasoline and diesel. It's gasoline and diesel with, as you already know, ethanol and biodiesel, but then renewable diesel and different types of ethanol, lower carbon ethanol. We're seeing increased natural gas. Now, in our program, when we did our projections, we included natural gas, but we didn't assume natural gas, the low carbon fuel standard, was going to drive natural gas sales. What we assumed is businesses would have an interest in natural gas because it's economically cheaper. Not everybody is going to convert. But when they do convert, they're going to look towards opportunities like renewable natural gas, which provide very low carbon pathway. So we're not saying, okay, folks are going to convert to natural gas because of this, but if they are going to convert, we have a method of making it cleaner. Similarly, we believe there will be folks that will be converted to electricity. We didn't think this drove it, but we think this should get encapsulated in it, and that if there are cleaner ways of producing the electricity, that should get wrapped in too. So those are the kinds of analyses that we've done.
Can I?
Yeah, please. I'm sorry.
Please quickly, and then we need to move on to, we have some people that have driven a long way, and we're going to go till 5:15, then we're done.
Chair, Senator, allow me to answer the quick question very quickly. I actually co-led six universities to study a national low-carbon fuel standard, look at different programs across the nation, can adopt a single low-carbon fuel standard. So we have dealt with issues about different baseline, even different reduction target, which is where we are now. So those issues can be addressed with the appropriate program design. And I would say that the baseline issue is not the most important issue because it's the 10% reduction. So you're going to start from 0%. And so it's the percent reduction that's the most important, not the absolute baseline numbers, because it's the credit generated from that percent deviation from the baseline that's important, that determine your credit prices.
Mr. Chair,
thank you.
Very brief question.
Please keep it brief.
This will be very brief. Who controls your credit market?
The credit market is, in terms of controls, it's arrangements between buyers and sellers. They come through us to clear it, in other words, to register it, but we do not get involved unless, in the current proposal, we have a cap on credit prices to ensure that the program doesn't have escalating fuel costs, but that is the extent of our involvement. And I understand Oregon program is similar.
What dollar amount does the state receive for this?
The state does not receive any funding in that credit transaction. So a buyer and a seller agree to sell at a price. They come together, they do their contract, and they inform ARB. Once ARB registers it, then it's an official transaction. But
and
we don't get.
And you're at $25 a ton, metric ton?
Yes, that's CARB's prices. And it's very consistent with trading prices that we've seen in different biofuel markets like Opus, Argus, and several markets.
And I do think that it's important to interject into this conversation because we haven't had the opportunity yet because we've been up against the clock. But the advisory committee, it's my understanding that the advisory committee report suggests one of the recommendations is that in Oregon, we cap the cost of a credit, so not allow it to go, because you said you had some fluctuation from, I think you said $10 up to $80. And
about that, yeah.
And one of the suggestions from the advisory committee was to cap it at 35. And at 35, I'm told, I haven't done the math myself, but I'm told that that's essentially a penny a gallon. So thank you both for being here. We appreciate it. So next, we are going to run 2 minutes. Now that we've gone through the expert panels, we're going to go 2 minutes apiece on the people that have come from a long way away and may not be able to make it back for Wednesday, okay? So we're going to start out with Ray Sealer from Tillamook and Frank Holmes.
Mr. Chair,
on deck we'll have I don't know if it's Dane or Dwayne Delahousie. I'm sorry if I butchered your name. And Carrie Nissen. Oh, excuse me, not Carrie Nissen, David Cox. So Dane Delahousie and David Cox will be on deck. Go ahead, please.
Good afternoon. Thank you for getting me on deck here as quick as possible. My name is Ray Sealer, and I'm general manager of Tillamook PUD. I'm in here in opposition to the low carbon fuel standard on behalf of the Oregon People's Utility District Association. The OPUDA members include five People's Utility Districts known as PUDs, which provide electric service to mostly rural Oregonians. Oregon's PUDs collectively serve over 193,000 people and deliver over 4 million megawatts of electricity to Oregonians annually. The OPUDA member utilities provide almost 400 family wage jobs in rural communities, representing more than $46 million in salary and benefits. Oregon and PUDs provide their customers with electricity that is more than 93% carbon-free, which is one of the highest rates of clean energy in the United States. The Oregon PUDs offer energy solutions supporting renewable energy, such as solar, wind energy, energy-efficient programs, and conservation as a resource. A solid mix of power resources reduces operational and fiscal risk and helps PUDs maintain safe, reliable, and affordable service for customers now and in the future. Cost to customers is a critical consideration when considering what new resources are truly sustainable and affordable to the public. That is why OPUDA opposes the low carbon fuel standards, which will increase the cost of fuel for our fleets and our customers. Oregon coastal and rural communities like Tillamook, Newport, Yahas, Capoose, Cottage Grove, and the Dells will be hardest hit under the LCFS, though they're just are some of the communities that we serve. Low-income and rural working families cannot afford to buy new vehicles and will suffer the high fuel prices. Rural Oregonians do not have alternate transportation. We do not have a choice about driving long distances. If the LCFS is about transferring money from one group to another, the rural Oregonian, you are transferring money from low-income Oregonians forced to drive their cars to wealthy private businesses and individuals. This program is truly regressive. The PUDs are urging you to reconsider this regressive fuel tax on rural Oregonians. Thank you,
Mr. Sealer. Go ahead.
Yes, my name is Frank Holmes. I'm the director for the Northwest Region for Western States Petroleum Association. I'm here today in opposition to 324. With 2 minutes, there's absolutely no way that I can get through all the information on this very, very complex, even though you've heard it simple, program. In the package that I gave you, there's a 4 pages worth of general comments that I would hope you would read. Also, there's some charts that I'd like to call your attention to quickly. But before we start talking about the charts, I need to point out that the comments that you've heard earlier about the program in California are a little bit misleading because the program has been frozen, as you've heard, and that's right. There hasn't been any problem because it's frozen at a level that there is plentiful available corn ethanol available to comply. The problem comes when you do not have carbon intensities of ethanol or biodiesels that can comply. In the graph that I'm pulling up here, that's the first graph in your book, this graph shows the current program. That's a list of all of the carbon pathways that is in the current Oregon rule. And those are the different manufacturing methodologies to get your ethanol from, and this example is for gasoline. And going across, it shows what carbon intensity you need to be able to comply, and you'll see that under the current rule, nothing complies after 4 years. so the program is infeasible. If you look at the next chart that shows the carbon intensity for the indirect land use component added into it, that will be done. DEQ has said that. Once that's added in, you have a program that goes infeasible in 2 years from a gasoline blending perspective. There is no ethanols in the U.S. that comply. You get a few more years by bringing in Brazilian sugarcane ethanol. But even after that, 4 years, it does not comply, even with Brazilian sugarcane. The next chart in there is from the DEQ report. That's from the ICS study that was done through the advisory committee. That also shows that there's insufficient supply to comply. And the last chart that's in there is the chart of the credit prices in California and shows the volatility of what happened. In October of 2012, the credit price was $12. In October of 2013, the credit price had risen over 1 year to $85 a ton. That is the point that they froze the program. And since there was plenty of ethanol available from Midwest corn, that price has moderated down. The problem comes when you reach that infeasible point. And so all the comments that you've heard about no cost increase in California and the program's working good, that's right. We haven't reached the problem point yet.
I do appreciate the information. I can assure you that I will personally read everything that you submit. And I know we don't have a lot of time. We have a lot of folks that want to testify on this. We will be carrying the hearing over till Wednesday. I know not everybody can be here, but I do appreciate your testimony and the submission of the materials. I will read them personally.
Okay. Any questions?
No.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks.
So next up, we have, looks like we have, are you Dane?
I'm Dane.
Dane, okay. And David.
Yes, sir.
Okay. And then after that will be Ryan Keeley. I don't know if I'm saying that right. And Ryan Lamberg.
I'll go first. Hi, good afternoon. Mr. Chairman, my name is Dane Delahousse, and I represent Neste Oil. Neste Oil is a traditional petroleum and refining and fuels marketing company. About 10 years ago, we expanded our business model to include production of renewable diesel, which is a petroleum hydrocarbon replacement made from traditional biodiesel-type feedstocks. We are currently the worldwide producer, worldwide leader in that, with a capacity of over 680 million gallons a year, and have been delivering commercial volumes to the British Columbia, the California, those sorts of things. Typically, our feedstocks from the waste and residues that come from get approximately a 60 or 70% reduction over the traditional whatever the baseline might be, and therefore, you know, 1 gallon of that has a bigger bang for a buck than one with a smaller reduction compared to that. From a producer's perspective, we would like to reiterate that a stable public policy is key to having an investment standpoint. Again, we made our investments and we spent over 2 billion euros in terms of production of getting this almost 700 million gallons of capacity a year. And it was done with the if you build it, they will come sort of concept. With it, having a stable thing, having a stable environment, having a stable demand market for that is key to have that kind of new technology development, have that kind of steel in the ground investment. And I would encourage Oregon that as they're serious about moving forward with trying to make some progress in both their local market and as their participant in a global market in terms of these cleaner fuels, in terms of these low in carbon intensity fuels, that a stable policy is paramount, is tantamount. You can't get a 2-year return on investment of billions of dollars in the ground. You'd have to look at a long-term horizon. So these turning left and right real quick on a whim, depending on little things, I would caution this body and the DCEQ that it comes out of it against that sort of thing, to have a stable environment for that.
Thank you.
Quick question?
Very, very quick.
regular price of diesel, you can buy a service station right now, versus a gallon of your renewable diesel, what's the cost?
They're comparable. That's without the, you know, the whatever, the RIN credit or the carbon credit, but the wet fuel itself is going to be comparably priced against diesel. So a consumer is going to get that.
Thanks. Quick question? Very quick. Sir, where is your plant located?
Sure, we have three facilities. One of them is in Finland, one is in Singapore, and one is in Rotterdam.
Do they have the stable certainty that you're requiring from here?
Yes.
Or did you make the investment without that stability?
It's a global market. We supply the United States. We supply to Europe. We supply to Southeast Asia. We supply to Canada. And the combination of all those different markets is the one that, you know, the global stability. But any one market to continue to incent growth like that needs to be stabilized.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is David Cox. I'm the Director of Operations for the Coalition for Renewable Natural Gas. We're a nonprofit trade association. We represent the full value chain of renewable natural gas within North America. And really, our members have supplied more than 90% of the biogas to transportation fuel that was produced in the United States last year. You heard earlier about the cellulosic biofuels that just never materialized. Quite frankly, it just took us a little bit longer to get our plants together and ramp up and be able to convert to transportation fuels for the prior uses, which were electricity and, in many cases, flaring of the gas where required by federal law. As Mr. Katowski testified to earlier from ARB, our industry has seen a fourfold growth since the inception of California's low carbon fuel standard. I'm here to testify in support of this program because we believe that the renewable natural gas industry would be one of the beneficiaries of it. Ultimately, we believe you have a cost-benefit analysis in the decision on this bill, and we wanted to bring our voice to that and thank you for your time and consideration of this bill today.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Next up, we have Ryan Keeley and Ryan Lamberg, and on deck is Curtis Martin.
Good evening, Chair Edwards, members of the committee. My name is Ryan Kenny. I'm with Clean Energy. We are the largest provider of natural gas transportation fuel in North America. We have over 550 stations, filling stations in 43 states. We were a early and continued supporter of California's LCFS and have been part of the process with DEQ as well and support this bill wholeheartedly. Just two quick comments. This policy goal, of course, is to reduce greenhouse gas emissions by 10% over 10 years, but the result of the bill also will indicate to the marketplace that the state of Oregon does support alternate transportation fuels. And that's important for a marketplace that is largely emerging with different transportation fuels. It's also important for a marketplace that needs to consider business planning over 3 to 5 years, if not longer. So this bill would definitely help in that regard. Finally, I'd like to make mention that you know, this bill would obviously go back and DEQ would do some rulemaking, and it's important we think that the legislature expresses the intent that the regulatory process be open, transparent, and respectful of stakeholders who have the technical expertise to make a positive contribution. We do urge support of this bill. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Edwards and members of the committee. My name is Ryan Lamberg. I serve as a technical advisor to the National Biodiesel Board. The National Biodiesel Board represents more than 150 production facilities and dozens of feedstock producers, distributors, retailers, and fleets. In addition to my work with the NBB, I co-founded Community Fuels, which is one of California's largest biodiesel production facilities. As a previous biodiesel producer and someone who's been in the trenches of the clean fuels economy for over a decade, I strongly encourage you to lift the sunset and allow the Clean Fuels program to move forward. I'd like to reiterate Jack and Dwayne's voice on stabilizing will offer fuel diversity as well as potentially lower prices. As you may know, biodiesel is the most cost-competitive, diverse, and commercially available low-carbon fuel in the market today. It's been tested, vetted, and proven as a wide range of fuel applications and fleets. Nationally, the biodiesel industry produced approximately 1.5 billion gallons of bio-based diesel fuel last year here in the U.S., with the capacity to produce over 2.5 billion gallons today. As America's first EPA-designated advanced biofuel, all domestic biodiesel surpasses a 50% carbon reduction threshold as compared to petroleum. In addition, biodiesel provides dozens of other air quality, energy security, economic, and health benefits that would provide that would extend beyond the goals of the program and should be considered as additional benefits of implementation. From farmers and well-paid, hardworking employees that see the direct benefit of their bottom line to consumers that benefit from fuel diversity and cleaner air, biodiesel is a win for Oregon. I know that my 2 minutes has been taken up. Those credits are gone. Just as exciting as the regional production, which we could do, 50 to 60% of these gallons could be produced with regional feedstocks, such as waste greases, inedible corn oils, and canola. So with the red light, I want to thank you for your innovation in moving this program forward. It will provide additional investment. We've seen that in California, and we'll hope to see that again in Oregon. Thank you.
And thank you for being here today to testify.
Thank you, Matt.
Questions? Curtis.
Thank you. Chris. Yes, thank you, Chair Edwards and members of the committee. I am Curtis Martin, and I'm here representing the Oregon Cattlemen's and the producers of Oregon. I would like to bring forward the negatives that impact the extension of the carbon fuel standard beyond the current sunset provisions. Our family is a family ranch. Us and our four sons are they are the seventh generation to be producing Oregon beef in Baker Valley. Today, I drove 324 miles to be here to give testimony, so I deeply appreciate you allowing me to slip in here and give my comments.
Late.
Yeah, it'll be a long night home, you bet. We operate in a very conscientious, sustainable manner, realizing the stewardship of the land and the water and the environment is in our hands. This increased cost of the fuel standard would threaten the economic viability of our family ranch. Continuing, everything in our community requires extended distances of delivery. For today, I traveled, like I mentioned, 324 miles to testify, and a distance of over 100 miles to 200 miles is commonplace for us to be able to take our cattle to pasture in the summertime and to winter feeding grounds. The fertilizer, the seed, all of the input items that we have to operate our ranch are going to be hugely impacted by the continuation of this standard. It seems to me, it seems like there's a lot of ambiguity here. It seems like to me we're rushing into an area that we don't have some facts to base what the economic impact is going to be. We would receive less for our commodities because there again, our cattle that we just delivered about 2 weeks ago had some of them traveled 650 miles, the others traveled 300 miles to their destination. So consequence of that would be we would receive less because it would cost less to get them transported there. Already, I wanted to bring forward that the current consequences we're realizing on our operation are the current ethanol. We cannot use that on our irrigation equipment, our small engines. We have to buy premium fuel now that is non-ethanol because they will not run. We have ruined engines after engines, a huge economic cost. And in closing, this serious damage on our eastern rural economy, of which Governor Kitzhaber has emphasized as a priority for assistance, this will just even further negatively impact, which we are very appreciative of, the recognition that the rural landscape needs to stay out there and the human element needs to be there and our culture is worthwhile. So with that, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you for being here, Curtis. Well, committee members, we're going to close it up for today. We're not closing the hearing. We're closing it. So we are going to carry over the public hearing to the next time we meet, which is Wednesday the 4th. So we'll carry over this public hearing.
Mr. Chair?
Yep.
I think just for the record, you probably want to also just put on the record as to what you said the limitations were in the sense of you're carrying it over to continue the
testimony. Yes, thank you for that clarification. Us rookies need some veterans looking over our shoulders. we are carrying over this public hearing until Wednesday for the purposes of continuing testimony and hearing testimony from those folks who were here and signed up today to testify. And with that, we are adjourned. We are adjourned. And with that.